Hey, folks, welcome back to Deep Fried Bites. What's up, Mr. Whatday?
Not too much. How about you, Keith?
Doing good. Ready to get this second episode kicked off here.
I know that first one was great, so I'm really excited about the second one.
Yeah, the second half of this is actually where we get into some really theoretical open source stuff and things. It turned into a really good conversation. And I think Harry's making some big plans about this, too, as well. So he's doing some stuff internally that this conversation may actually help him out, and that'll be good.
Yeah. And hey, so if anyone's new, because of Harry's little push, and I know he's getting a lot of his friends around the community to blog and Twitter about this episode. So if you're new to Deep Fried Bites, welcome, and hope you stick around.
Just a quick public service announcement. Don't forget Code Stock is coming up, folks. It's right around the corner. If you haven't registered, be sure that you register. We just got a speakers list today that came out. We got some really, really great speakers on there. Don't forget about getting out and registering for Code Stock, okay?
And yep, that's in Knoxville, Tennessee. So codestock.org. Okay.
That's right. All right, folks. Well, here we go. This is the second part of Harry Pearson's interview with Iron Python and some open source. Hope you enjoy it. Thanks for tuning in.
Thanks.
So, Harry, where is this DLR at? Where does it live on the file system? I mean, give me the paths. I mean, where does it live at?
Well, today, it does not ship in the box in .NET 2.0 or .NET, any of the .NET 2, .NET 3, .NET 3.5, right? It doesn't ship in the box. If you download and install Iron Python, you'll see there's a bunch of DLLs. There's ironpython.dll, which is the core runtime and compiler for Iron Python. There's Iron Python modules, which is a bunch of, it's sort of like the Iron Python BCL, if you will, right? The standard Python library that ships with Python. We've implemented a significant part of it, not all of it yet. We're working on that in C# for use in Iron Python in order to make, so that you can run your Python application in either CPython or Iron Python. And then there's a bunch of DLLs that start with Microsoft.scripting. Microsoft Scripting, Microsoft Scripting Core, and Microsoft Scripting Extension Attribute.
Isn't there a Silverlight one too?
There's a Silverlight.
Isn't there a Silverlight?
For Silverlight, there's Microsoft Scripting Silverlight. Sorry, I was just thinking of the desktop version. Those are the DLR, right? Microsoft Scripting Core, and Microsoft Scripting Extension Attribute. Though that's sort of a funky one, which we can talk about if you want. The reason it's split. So let's just talk about Scripting and Scripting Core, right? Because those are the two main ones. It's split like that because what's in Microsoft Scripting Core today is what's going to be in System Core in CLR 4.0, in .NET Framework 4.0. So we're basically shipping the next version of System Core today, open source, Microsoft public license, and shipping Iron Python 2.0 and Iron Ruby 0.3 on top of that infrastructure today. There's more stuff in Microsoft Scripting which we haven't locked down, which will likely be included in the framework sometime after CLR 4, but not today. So this would include things like the hosting API. There is an interpreter in there for being able to interpret DLR trees, some other stuff in there as well. But that's sort of this main separation between the stuff that's going to be in the .NET framework in 4.0 and the stuff that's going to continue to ship with the language implementations down the road. The Silverlight DLL that you mentioned, this is a special code for being able to build Silverlight applications using DLR languages, i.e. Python and Ruby.
Well, how do you get... Okay, so you said that was going to be... That's C# 4.0 core. How are you guys keeping that in sync, like the core, and then you're putting it over here?
Well, so the... We have, we're building internally every day the .NET Framework 4.0 stuff, and we push out to the public via, on the CodePlex website. We ship. I think the DLR guys are publishing once a week. We're publishing two or three times a day. So we just take what's in our tree. We do some transforms on it. Because it's essentially the next version of System Core, we don't want we don't want collision between today's system core and the DLR, so we transform a lot of the namespaces. So stuff that would be like, you know, system.expressions.trees becomes Microsoft.expressions.trees in the DLR today. But by the time we actually ship, it'll be in system. If you're a language guy, if you're working at the Python level, you won't notice any of those changes. So that's completely transparent. This is sort of low level. If you're building your own language, then you care. But if you're building your if you're building with a language, be it C# 4 or Iron Python or whatever, the inner workings of the DLR are sort of irrelevant to you.
So here's a question. We had a big conversation on Twitter today about this. Can I submit patches to Iron Python?
Not today.
No. Not today.
So
it's coming soon to a theater near you.
Well, I mean,
or
I can tell you what I believe, right? I believe that we should, right? And I've been very vocal about this. As you might imagine, one of my roles as the program manager for the Dynamic Languages team is to spend a lot of time talking to lawyers. And so, I mean, I don't have anything to announce or anything like that, but I think that it would be a good thing for Microsoft to be able to collaborate with members of the community who are so inclined in order to improve the product. As you might imagine, for a company that sells intellectual property like Microsoft, there are various legal concerns, and the fact that we're shipping more and more software today is open source, right? So the GUI announced yesterday that ASP.NET MVC 1.0, that ASP.NET MVC is now Microsoft public license. I know the MEF guys, I don't know what their license is, but I know they're shipping source. I don't know what their future plans around shipping source are. We're shipping source, obviously, here in Iron Python, and the Iron Ruby guys are shipping their source. We're shipping the source to the DLR. F# is available today under a research license. I don't know what they're doing for the future. Obviously, you can get access to the source code of the .NET framework. Microsoft's slowly but surely opening up when it comes to source code. And I think at some point, somebody who might work on the Iron Python team will go on and take on the lawyers and try and make it so that we can collaborate with the community, because I think that would be a good thing. Unfortunately, you know, there's a lot of inertia against that.
Well, that's kind of what the conversation was today.
Lazy coder, right?
Kicked that off this morning.
Lazy coder on this.
Well, he got pulled in, and
I didn't see the whole stream, but I saw his initial comment about should that be the first thing that happens to a Microsoft public license project, that that the community forks it so that they can take contributions, and that's happened in Iron Python, right? So there's a version of Iron Python available called the Community Edition. It's called FiPy, right? You know, Fi is the symbol for iron on the periodic table. And this is it's a version of Iron Python. It's got a bunch of patches to it. We include the standard library now in Iron Python. So I mentioned that there's a DLL, Iron Python .modules. There's also a bunch of modules that are actually written in Python. And we actually shipped those in the box with Iron Python today. That was one of the first things I had to do from a lawyer perspective in my job a year ago, you know, about 9 months ago, was get permission to include this Python Software Foundation intellectual property in the box with Iron Python. And of course, today we're also now shipping jQuery. That's another example of the same kind of thing, where we ship, you know, code that somebody else wrote in our box. So we're making progress in this space. I think there's a lot more progress to be made in this space. Well, I was going to say, the one thing I would say to somebody like Lazy Coder who made the comment about, you know, should we fork? The problem with this is that, you know, Microsoft, this is a product for Microsoft. Right, so, you know, we don't have an army, and there's a lot more guys working on, say, Windows and Office than there are, say, working on Iron Python, right? We've got, you know, it's about 6 or 7 guys on the DLR team, and we have 3 testers and developers and 1 program manager. So it's not a big team, but we're working on new features every single day. And if you take a project like Iron Python and you fork it, then what happens is that, you know, the work that you're doing, unless you're going to do the work to continuously merge in the changes that are coming from Microsoft, then you end up with these two sort of very disparate projects. And certainly, you know, I'd rather there not be a need for that, right, personally. I'd like there to be able to say, hey, look, we're all going to collaborate in this space.
Thank you, because
but I'm not the guy who gets to make the decisions about this.
Well, here's the thing from this whole backstory with this. I started this morning, and I saw some people twittering.
The backstory goes back all the way 8 hours.
It really does. I mean, this morning I was watching that, you know, ASP.NET is, you know, MVC is open source, quote, and I'm like, well, it's not really open source because, I mean, yes, this has an open source license, and the OSI approved the license, but to me, from a guy that came back from the 90s and watching the spirit of open source, it was that, yes, I can get the source code to it, but I can also collaborate with the original authors and stuff and add contributions and stuff. Now, some people have said, look, you know, because it's open source, you don't get that just for free. Like, you don't get that just because it's open source. And I understand that. But I also understand that the spirit of things like Linux and MySQL, which is a company, PHP and Apache and those things, have evolved much, much better because of that collaboration. And so I kind of threw this Easter egg out there and was like, it's not really open source. And then some people started cheering and going back and forth, and I was sort of getting hammered. And then Lazy Coder jumped in later on and was like, I totally agree with, you know, Keith, that it really should be, the thing that we're missing is that collaborative piece. And maybe we'll get there. I mean, maybe we'll get there. We're starting to see, you know, Microsoft sort of crawl out of the legal trenches, so to speak, and you're putting out Iron Python, you've got CodePlex, you sort of got the pieces. We just got to take those next extra steps.
So you guys know, we do take contributions in Iron Ruby. Right? So you can sign an agreement with Iron Ruby, and you can then submit patches to the library, the equivalent of the BCL for Ruby. You can submit patches there. Now, you know, that's a start, right? We're inching, and you're not going to get any argument from me as to the relatively slow speed in which that these changes are happening. But I mean, imagine going back 4 years and saying, you know, Microsoft's going to take this brand new infrastructure that for building web apps, and we're going to both A, ship it as open source, and B, include open source, you know, technology that came from outside of the company in an open source project in the box with that. We're making progress. Maybe not as fast as some people would like. Maybe not as fast as I would like, to be perfectly blunt. But we're making progress on that front.
So I'm going to throw a little bit into this. Is people always think that open source is a democracy. It's not a democracy.
It's rarely a democracy.
You can
you show me.
It's rarely. In Python,
you show me a successful open source project, and I will show you a benevolent dictator for life. Right.
Exactly. And that's Python.
Python has Guido van Rasmussen. He is they refer to him as the BFDL, BDFL, benevolent dictator for life. In Linux, it's, you know, Linus, right? So I think that the idea that it's not a pure democracy or a pure meritocracy. There has to be someone who makes the decisions. But I agree with you that there's degrees of open source, right? The .NET framework, you can see the source code, but you can't change it, you can't take it, you can't do anything with it other than look at it and, you know, debug through it. Convenient, but not really open source. Iron Python, ASP.NET MVC, you can take the source code, you can fork it, you can do whatever you want with it. I'd argue that is open source, but it isn't collaborative.
It isn't openly collaborative open source. It's open source based on the license, right? But it's not openly collaborative open source.
And Iron Ruby.
But by the definition of open source, it is open source because we get the source code, we can do
whatever we
want.
And I'm a very big believer that collaborative open source would be a very good thing for Microsoft. My name is not Steve Ballmer. My name is not Bill Gates or Ray Ozzie. I don't get to make those decisions. But believe me, I have conversations with lawyers all the time.
Well, I mean, my big thing about it, you know, Harry, is that, you know, I don't want to see all this forking and stuff because it just like you said, it creates chaos of merging. You don't have one source of the truth.
What ends up happening is either A, you fork and you each go off in a separate direction, in which case they're no longer compatible, or B, the guy who's doing the fork has to spend an inordinate amount of wasted time merging those, you know, features that are coming from Microsoft into the community fork. Neither of these are very good solutions. I think that we can do better.
Absolutely. That's kind of my whole point. I want everybody to sort of get together and go, this is the one truth. You know, now you still need that dictator there to say, okay, I'm not taking that patch or I'm not going to put that feature in because A, we're going to do it better, or B, we don't care. You know, so you need somebody there to sort of run the reins of things.
Yeah, but when you're however many billion-dollar company Microsoft is, which that billions and billions and billions, I don't remember how many it is, to be perfectly honest, that is entirely from selling intellectual property. And when you are in the business of selling intellectual property, it behooves you to be very, very cautious as to how you change the process in which you create intellectual property. And I wish it would be faster, but, you know, I'm a pretty small minority stakeholder here. Stockholder.
So I've got a question. How is Microsoft handling, and you guys handling, changes that are coming from Guido's side and the normal Python?
We call that, just so you know, we call that C Python, the C implementation of Python. So
how are those changes coming in? And then how do you envision Microsoft bringing stuff into Python? And are you going to take some of the changes that Microsoft and your team dreams up and give that back to C Python?
So let's remember for a sake of argument here that there's two separate pieces here, right? There's the base runtime virtual machine, and then there's the libraries, right? You see this across the board, right? So you have in .NET, you have the CLR, and you have the base class library. In Python, you have the runtime, the VM, if you will, and you have the Python standard library, the PSL. And so we take, on the library side, it's easy. We ship what they ship, right? Literally, when you install IronPython today via the MSI, there's an option to install the standard library, and when you click through the EULA, there's actually two licenses. You know, one is for IronPython, which is the MSPL, and one is for the Python standard library, which is the Python standard license. You'd have to talk to the lawyers about the specifics on the differences and stuff like that. So when we ship 2.6, so we just shipped IronPython 2.6 Alpha 1, we, you know, took down the latest, you know, we got a merge of the latest source of the libraries and included in the box. And it turns out that there's some broken things, that they've made some changes that don't work very well with IronPython that we're going to have to fix. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that's broken. In the case of the libraries, you know, we take what they have, and there are some certain libraries that don't work. Right, so if you look at the full source code, there are some libraries that are specifically designed to work on Mac or Unix. We don't ship those. There are some libraries that are designed to work on Python on Windows but don't work on IronPython. I'll give you an example. There's a module called submodule, which is for, you know, forking processes. And submodule is a big if statement. If you're running on Unix, do this. Otherwise, assume you're running on Windows. And unfortunately, you know, the CLR, neither of those two processes work. So if you try to use the subprocess module, it's broken. I would like to be able to see implementing a new version of subprocess and submitting it back to the Python Software Foundation. But this is something that requires getting lawyers' approval, because it means we're going to take Microsoft IP and give it to somebody else. And typically when that happens, you know, somebody with a much higher pay grade than yours truly has to approve it. You know, somebody with general manager or vice president in the title. We are doing it, right? Again, to go back to Iron Ruby, those guys are submitting back to the RSpec project, the Ruby spec project, and we are submitting our IP as part of that. And so there is some precedence for doing that, and we're slowly but surely moving in that direction.
But is there really anything stopping Harry from Saturday morning coding that at home in his PJs and then submitting that back to the Python?
No, but there's also nothing stopping anybody from doing it, right? So there's nothing stopping Mike.
But you know it's broke, and you know how
sure.
to fix it, though. Not everybody
else
does.
Okay, so that may be true, but there's a lot of, implementing subprocess, there's a lot of people. Anybody in the IronPython community could probably implement that. And so somebody say, like, again, we'll pick on Michael Ford. Michael Ford was just approved as a member of the Python Software Foundation, as was Dino Vehand, who's our lead dev, and Jim Huguenin's been a member of it for a long time. So any of these guys can, you know, submit patches. The difference is that if I go through and submit a patch without getting approval from my boss, you know, that might affect my, you know, success factor, my career stage profile at Microsoft. So regardless of whether I'm doing it in my PJs on Saturday morning or whether I'm doing it in the office, you know, as is typical for a company like Microsoft, the work that I do, you know, in the context of my job, and obviously anything involving the Python software library would qualify, you know, is Microsoft. So I would have to be very careful about that. Besides which, I don't want there to be, like, we're going to do it on the side because it's not, because we're not supposed to. I want to make it right. I want to make it okay. I want to make it the standard way of approaching this, that when Microsoft says, hey, we've got some implementations, I'll give you an example. We have tons of tests that we own that, you know, are over and above what the standard library implements. We would like to be able to submit those, but we have to go through and set up a framework in order to enable that, so that once we do it once, we can keep doing it rather than doing it in an ad hoc fashion. I want to change the way we do things. I don't want to do things, you know, I don't want to get fed up and do it on Saturday morning in my PJs.
Well, I totally agree with your approach. I mean, do it right and make it
do it above it board. I mean, and
yeah.
So my follow-up question is, what's Guido think about Iron Python?
He likes it quite a bit. The Python Foundation, the Python software community is very, very embracing of alternative virtual machines. I mentioned that we just had PyCon. There were two summits that preceded PyCon. I didn't attend them, but Dino and Jim did. One on the language and one on the virtual machine. And so they had, the virtual machine one had representatives from all kinds of different groups, guys from the various Ruby implementations, all the major Python implementations, the Java guys, of course, the CLR guys. I mean, we had a ton of representation there from VMs all over. And those guys are taking specific steps in order to make, in order to embrace these alternative implementations. It turns out there's actually four major implementations of Python today. There's the standard C Python. There's IronPython. There's Jython, which is, again, Python on the Java virtual machine, originally started by Jim, but now owned by Sun, the major, a lot of the guys, not all of them, but some of the significant contributors to that work for Sun today. There's an implementation called PyPy, which is Python written in Python, more of an academic exercise, but they've got some very interesting stuff, including the ability to actually generate Java bytecode or .NET IL on the back end. In fact, one of the things that's fascinating, one of the areas that we run into bugs with Python, is that Python uses a reference counted garbage collector. So if you've ever done, you know, COM stuff, add release, right? We all remember add reference and release. That's how the Python garbage collector works. Obviously, the garbage collector in IronPython uses the .NET mark and sweep garbage collector, which is, you know, many would consider more advanced. The Java guys, obviously, they're not using a add reference or add and release reference counting garbage collector either. And several years ago, when IronPython was still sort of getting started, the IronPython, we went to those guys and said, you know, what do we say here, right? Our behavior is never going to match the behavior of Python. And Guido basically stood up and said, if you depend on the garbage collection performance of CPython, that's a bug, right? This is an implementation detail that will vary from Python implementation to Python implementation. And you need to write your code in such a way so that you don't depend on that. And in fact, one of the things that was added to Python in 2.5 was a with statement. And C Sharp, you would know that as a using statement. So there's an automatic way that I can declare that I want to dispose of an object when I exit this block. As you can expect, anything that's idisposable in .NET works exactly correctly in the with statement in Python. Anyway, so one of the benefits of that is that if I have some piece of behavior that's dependent on the garbage collector, right, this file has to be disposed at this point because I need the file to be closed. Well, now you've got these very common semantics between I dispose and with statement. I forget the there's a context manager, I believe is what it's called in Python. And it's very similar semantics. So you can do pretty much the same exact thing in both of those two spaces. And that allows you to be more independent of the behavior of the garbage collector. At PyCon, one of the most popular sessions was the Python implementers panel. And they had five guys up there. They had a guy from Jython. They had Dino from IronPython. They had a guy from PyPy, a guy from CPython. And then the other interesting thing that's happening in the Python space is the Google announced a project called Unladen Swallow. If you didn't know, Python is not named for the snake. It's named for Monty Python. So oftentimes, projects are named Monty Python references. The website where you can download Python packages is called The Cheese Shop, for example. you will often see spam and knee in code samples in Python. And unladen swallow is an attempt to improve the performance of the standard CPython library, CPython implementation. Google is a very big user of Python, so you can expect that it's very clear that any performance gains they can get out of Python will be very good for them.
Harry, I used to work in Python probably back around 2000, and I was reading up on it, and I saw an interesting thing about this thing called the Global Interpreter Lock, the GIL, regarding multi-core CPUs. And it said that a CPython application can be multi-threaded, but those threads cannot live across multiple cores of a CPU. So will Iron Python behave like that, or will it work on multiple cores of a CPU?
Okay, so my understanding of the GIL, the Global Interpreter Lock, is that basically only one thread in a process can be executing Python bytecode. I don't think it makes any difference about cores. But then again, I'm not a deep expert on the CPython runtime. Regardless of how it works in CPython, like the garbage collector, this is an implementation detail. Iron Python does not have any global interpreter lock. You can very easily spin up as many threads as you want. They can all be running Python, because in the end, everything that gets all this Python code is getting compiled down to IL. So anything you would expect to do in an IL app, in a C# application or a Visual Basic application, from a threading perspective, you can do from Iron Python as well.
Harry, Sean Woodermuth wrote into us, one of our good friends, been on the show before, said, there seems to be a lot of Iron Star. I think he was looking at like Iron Ruby and Python examples, but they're not mixed. And Iron Ruby is a great language for testing, as perf doesn't matter. And of course, duck typing makes it a lot easier to mock stuff. And he wanted to know if there were any examples where you have static languages and dynamic languages together. And do you see that as useful?
Well, we talked about the embedding scenario earlier, right? The idea that I'm going to embed Python as an executable language for scripting or for business rules or even as an application environment in the case of resolver systems. So I think there's certainly those scenarios that fit into the concept of using these two together. I think testing is another really good example. The ability to, in fact, I believe Jimmy Cimenti, who's the on the Iron Ruby team, he recently posted a whole thing about using Iron Ruby as a test framework for statically typed languages. So I think that's another very good use of dynamic languages. Again, I think what's interesting about these dynamic languages from a testing perspective is if you're writing your core application in the dynamic language, testing it is easier. Because it's easier to, when you're using something like duck typing, if you want to mock out a file, right? Think of it this way. I don't know if you've ever tried to do any unit testing of the file system, but in .NET, you've got all these static types, and it's this real big hassle, right? So it's really difficult to unit test code that's talking to the file system. I remember looking at the source code to the CodePlex client, which was originally written by, Brad Wilson, now on the ASP.NET team, and he'd built this entire layer on top of the file system so that he could test it. Obviously, that's another thing that happened with ASP.NET is that they introduced these new interfaces to allow you to be able to do testing on your so that you can test your controllers and what have you outside of the scope of the web server, because it's just this, you obviously don't want to run all of your tests. You need to be able to run your tests in a constrained environment. So, I think testing is a really good scenario, but I think where dynamic languages really shine is not unit testing statically typed languages, but unit testing dynamically typed languages.
Okay, Harry, thanks for answering that question for Sean. Another user wrote in named David on Twitter. He's called Terse, T3RSE. He said, access and use of standard Python libraries versus .NET, like import OS versus using system.io. What are your thoughts on that?
So my typical thoughts on this are that we implement the standard Python library in order to be compatible with scripts that run on Python. Right? So if you write a script on Python, you expect import OS to be there. If you don't care about compatibility with other versions of Python, then you might probably make the argument that using the .NET framework directly is going to be faster, because, of course, we build a wrapper around the .NET framework in order to provide the compatibility with modules like OS. So when you call into OS path and you do join, well, somewhere underneath there, it's calling system.io.path.combine. If you just call combine directly, you know, you're bypassing those extra steps. So it's a question of which is more important to you. Do you care about compatibility with CPython or don't you? I'll be perfectly honest, I try to write a lot of, you know, like I've been working on IPy debugs, this command line debugger for Python. One of the things is I have multiple copies of Python installed on my machine. I have the standard version of 2.0.1. I have the new 2.6 alpha. I have some copies of like the main branch that are up on, I've got a website called Nightly Builds where you can get, you know, basically every build of Iron Python that we release. I compile it up and package it in a zip file so you can download it. And so I have lots and lots of different copies. And I also have some that are compiled for debug because the debug version of Iron Python has some additional capabilities. One of the things that you find is that if you're not running with the standard library, there's all this stuff that has to get loaded on startup when you run with the standard library. And it's one of the things that contributes to Iron Python's slow startup time. Now, we're fixing some of this in 2.6. We're changing to an interpreter-based mode for a lot of startup. We call it adaptive compilation. But in the short version is that if you go and run Iron Python 2.0.1 with and without the standard library, it starts a lot faster without it. So I'll find that I'm a lot more productive if I'm writing code that if I'm writing Iron Python debugger, that's never going to run on C#. That's never going to run on CPython. So there's no point in trying to use the standard Python libraries when I can use the .NET ones. And it means that, you know, I bypass those layers of indirection. And it means that my application starts up faster because I'm not running in a context that, you know, loads the Python standard library at all.
Harry, bottom line, what's the performance of Iron Python compared to CPython?
Depends on the test. there are certain things, because we're a compiled instead of an interpreted environment, there are certain things that we do very, very well, like an order of magnitude better than CPython. And there are some things that we do very, very poorly. Notably in that space, and I know you want to do rusty washers here, and we'll get to that in a minute, our performance on exceptions is horrific compared to CPython. The Python environment actually has exceptions that are marked in the documentation as this is not an error. They're used for flow control. When you get to the end of a generator, like an enumerator with yield in C# terminology, it throws an exception. That's how it indicates that it's at the end of a generator loop. And we have a very different belief around exceptions in the .NET framework, and they are. Rico Moroni made a comment that they are, you know, throw an exception when you don't mind, if you don't mind it if the computer beeps 3 times and goes to sleep for 2 seconds, then you should throw an exception. So there's a very different belief structure around exceptions, and because we've mapped these lightweight exceptions that Python uses in some cases for flow control to these very heavyweight slow exceptions that are only used in the cases of exceptional circumstances in .NET, it's a pretty big deal. To give you an indent, if you exclude the test around exceptions from the standard Py benchmark, we go from being like 60% performance, like so 40% slower, to being 10% faster. Literally, almost like 44% of our test runtime is in this exception test. So, you know, one of those rusty washers, right? It's our exception performance is pitiful compared to Iron Python, but across the board and everything else, we're pretty fast, and we're getting faster all the time. One of the things I mentioned earlier about the new 2.6 implementation is that one of the reasons we have this slow startup time is because we go off and we compile, you know, every file that gets referenced, we go off and compile the whole thing into IL. Well, you know, even if you're going to run one function out of it, you're going to compile everything to IL. The IL stuff gets compiled just in time. What we're starting to do now with Python code is we're compiling, you know, the DLR trees to IL just in time. And in fact, what we really do is we'll actually interpret it the first time you call it, the first couple of times. Because if you're calling an initialization function once, it's faster to just interpret it rather than go through the overhead of compiling it and then calling it. If you're going to call it a lot of times, then you want to compile it. So we have an adaptive model so that like the first couple of times you call it, it gets interpreted, and then at some point it says, you know, he seems to be calling this a lot. Let's take the hit and compile it so that way from now on it'll be a lot faster.
Okay, folks, it's time for another segment of Rusty Washers. Here we go.
For those who don't know, we do a little thing here on Deep Fried Bites called Rusty Washers and Shiny Pennies. If you've ever seen a demo or watched a presentation and you thought it was absolutely awesome, you got back to home, you started coding it, you started trying to use it, and it just turned into an old rusty washer instead of a shiny penny. So that's what this segment is about. So, Harry, you talked us all into going and installing Iron Python and playing with it. What are some rusty washers we're going to run into out there?
So I mentioned earlier about how great the .NET interop is. It's awesome. However, it's not 100%. Two things leap to mind in this space. First is, because we're not generating a static type, we don't support custom attributes. So if you've ever built, you know, a WCF contract, right? If you've done XML serialization, though, as I mentioned earlier, you don't want to do XML serialization. If you build unit tests using any of the standard .NET unit test frameworks, they all depend on static types and custom attributes, and we don't support those today. There are some new features coming in 2.6 that we might be able to use. I'm experimenting with them right now, but I found out about them yesterday, so I can't get into more detail about that. But we are trying to make these better going down the road. But for now, if you need a custom exception, a custom attribute, Python's not the language for you. The other thing that bit me recently, I was working on the debugger, and if you're familiar with C#, you know that when you declare a type, you can declare it as a struct, or you can declare it as a class. So classes, those are created on the heap, and structs are created on the stack. However, C# will sort of transparently, if you say I want to make a reference to this integer as an object, it will automatically box, right? So that's the terminology that's used. I can box mm-hmm. an integer as a reference type, and I can unbox it later and get back the original version.
Right, right.
Of course, the thing is that when you do this boxing and unboxing, what you're doing is you're making copies, right? So if I say I'm going to box an integer, so I've got an integer on the stack. I cast it to an object, and then I cast it back to an integer. I've got three separate copies of it. I've got the original copy, I've got the copy in the heap, and I've got the copy that I've cast to. And the problem with that is that this sort of flies... In Python, everything's an object. So if you've got a struct and you want to manipulate it, you can't manipulate it directly. Because when you go and you say, I want to get access to this thing, it'll say, okay, it's an object. So I've boxed it. So now it's living on the heap. So with the original copy of it, you're now manipulating a copy of it. So if you were to go in and say, I've got this random struct, and it's a point, let's say, and I'm going to say point.x equals 7 and point.y equals 14, you've modified the copy. You haven't modified the original version. Hmm. And so that's a problem. So we
could
actually don't allow you.
Could be buggy in an application or something like that. You would definitely not get the expected.
Exactly. Well, what we do is we actually don't allow you to update value types in Python. So if you create an instance of a value type in Python and you go to manipulate the values in it, it doesn't work. Now, if you're building now, obviously there's a couple of things with this. You can construct a value type, and Python uses a similar kind of object initializer syntax like C#. So what I was doing in the example I was having is these were step ranges for the debugger. I, passed in the start and end step range as part of the constructor, and so that works correctly. So for me, I was able to work around it. If you need to pass it around and manipulate it, you can call the if you have a method on the function, you can call the method. Right, so if I have a point and it has a set x function and a set y function, you can call set x and set y. You just can't directly manipulate x and y. So that was a little bit of a rusty washer. Obviously, it's a question of the nature of Python. That Python doesn't really have this concept of boxing and unboxing, and so it was one of those places where, like the exceptions, the design philosophy didn't quite match, and so we had to do the best that we could given the circumstances.
Over the weekend, Harry, you and I were talking about, stuff on Twitter because you were at the PyCon and I was sort of jumping in there. And one of the things I'd mentioned was, you know, I really wish, you know, IronPython and Django were included in the web application installer that was just coming out from Mix. And you had mentioned something that, well, we're not really 100% compatible yet. Kind of go into that for me just a little bit, because I you kind of threw it out there, and I was like, okay, well, I'm going to ask him when he gets on the show.
No problem. So Python has two different string types, standard Python, an ASCII string type and a Unicode string type. If you're familiar at all with .NET, you probably understand that the .NET string type is Unicode only. And so in IronPython, strings and Unicode are basically aliases for each other. So you don't convert a string to a Unicode or a Unicode to a string. You don't do those, or at least they're no ops. And some frameworks depend on the fact that, you know, and especially, you know, you can imagine a web application framework that does a lot of text processing. There's a lot of code in there in order to make sure that they do Unicode correctly. And because of the fact that they assume that string and Unicode are different types, and they're not on IronPython, that runs into a few collisions. We actually demoed Django running on IronPython last year at PyCon. And my understanding from talking to Dino is that it's a very small change. It's like 4 or 5 lines of code. But we need the Django guys to make those changes. We haven't been very proactive about running that down with them, and that's something I think we need to do. That's my responsibility, and I spent most of the last year getting up to the speed of the point I am now. One of the things that's happening in the Python space, it's good and it's bad, is they recently released Python 3.0, or Python 3000 as it's known. And Python 3000 is not backwards compatible. So they took the opportunity to sort of remove a bunch of old stuff from the language that they didn't like very much anymore. Python in the 2x branch has old style and new style classes. In Python 3000, they've gotten rid of old style because they're old, hence the name.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
One of the things they've done in Python 3000 is they've unified on a single Unicode string type. So there's no longer going to be, you know, ASCII strings and Unicode strings. So we believe that when Python 3000 becomes sort of widely adopted, we're going to be significantly more compatible with those. Because, again, especially in web frameworks, this turns out to be a significant source of errors. Unfortunately, you know, as you can imagine, with anything that's not backwards compatible, the adoption rate on Python is on Python 3000 is not huge. I believe the Django guy said that they think they'll have, you know, an alpha or a prototype of Django running on Python 3 next year at PyCon. So, and frankly, we don't have a Python 3000 version yet either. But again, that's primarily because it doesn't look like the community's moving to it very quickly. So we want to make sure that we stick with what the community wants rather than, you know, barging ahead and doing something that's just good for us. I would love to see a version of Django running in the web application installer. I have notes from that Twitter conversation, actually, to investigate that. I've got Lang.net coming up in 2 weeks, so I got to get past that before I can start really doing anything like that. But I once I get a little bit more free time, that's one of the things that I definitely want to look at.
Cool. So we have only a few more minutes, and we always ask our guests the most important question. So the most important question is, what is your favorite deep-fried food?
So a couple of years ago, my grandparents on my father's side lived in upstate New York. And we went up to visit them a couple of summers ago. And my son, I think, was 3 and my daughter was 1. And we went to Syracuse. So this is Oswego, New York, for those of you who might know where that is. It's about an hour away from Syracuse, 45 minutes. And so they were having the New York State Fair in Syracuse. So we went and we had deep fried Oreos. I had never seen or heard of deep fried Oreos. You know, all the normal, you know, deep fried meats, you know, fried chicken, those kind of things. You're used to those. You know, you see, my wife likes to make fried eggplant. That's a pretty big one in our house.
That's good. I like that.
Slightly more healthy, I guess, than fried Oreos. And I'd heard about fried Twinkies before, but I'd never actually seen one. I didn't quite go for the Twinkies, but I did have to try. There's like my father, my wife, and I, you know, there was 3 of them for like $1. So we did that, and we each had one. I didn't need to know those existed. So,
I think Ellie Mae introduced the previous show with deep fried Oreos, didn't she, Woody?
Yeah, drizzled with chocolate and
I don't need to know this.
And colored sprinkles or something like that.
Colored sprinkles and stuff.
Yeah,
great.
Oh, that's good. That's awesome.
I'm not sure it's my favorite, but it's certainly the most memorable, the one that leaps to mind when you ask. So,
well, that's cool. That's cool. Well, you know what? We really appreciate you coming on board. I mean, we started talking to you about coming on to Deep Fried Bites way back at PDC, and we finally got you on. And I hope you had a good time, and I know we did. I know we learned a lot tonight.
Cool.
From our conversation, so thank you. Harry, what's your blog?
I write DevHawk. DevHawk.net. DevHawk.
Okay, so,
DevHawk.
Okay, great. So we have DevHawk, and what is your Twitter handle?
Yes.
Probably DevHawk.
I'm going with DevHawk.
Yeah, DevHawk. So,
yep. Where'd you get the hawk from, man?
When I was coming up with the website, this was years ago. I mean, this was before blogging, really. I mean, I had the website, and I wanted to start a company. This was actually before I started at Microsoft, called DataHawk, and DataHawk was taken when I went to go start my own personal website. And so I thought about it for a while, and I really liked the Hawk name, and so I settled on DevHawk, and it was available. So that was a big piece of the decision-making process.
The answer is it was available, I think.
I think that's the big thing for any web venture nowadays. Yeah, it was available.
That's where we got Deep Fried Bites. It was, we could buy the domain, you know. It was awesome.
There you go.
Plus, it sounded good and tasty. So
it does. Not quite as tasty as deep fried Oreos, but you know, hey, we'll give you guys a break.
Yeah, well, you know, you can't win them all. Well, Harry, we certainly appreciate you coming on. Folks, we certainly appreciate you tuning in to today's show. As always, you can reach us online at comments@deepfriedbites. Send us your queries and posers out there. You can also reach us online at twitter.com/deepfriedbites. We always ask you to give us a follow, and we will follow you back because we want to be able to contact you through direct messages, and you contact us as well. Woody, it was a pleasure. Harry, thanks again for coming on the show.
Yeah, okay? Thanks, Harry.
No problem.
All right, folks. Until next time, keep those tea glasses full and those axes sharp. We'll see you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.